From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the agony of the Michigan Democrat primary vote this Super Tuesday.
But certainly that's been the experience of Michiganders for many election cycles, that by the time the circus comes to town, it's basically over.
We'll talk with Brian Dickerson of the Detroit Free Press about the dwindling choices that will be on the ballot by the time March 10th rolls around. So will you have to spoil your absentee ballot?
So if you've already cast your ballot for, say, Pete Buttigieg, you can cancel your ballot.
And massive spending from the Bloomberg campaign in Michigan.
Some of the mail pieces that some voters are likely getting are probably different than the mail pieces that other voters are getting. I mean, that's what sophisticated campaigns do. And when you have a lot of money, you're able to be more sophisticated than others.
All that's coming up on Stateside. Stay with us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's program, Democratic presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg spends millions of dollars on TV and radio ads in Michigan. More, in fact, than both of the Democratic and Republican candidates spent on the run-up to the primary in 2016.
Bloomberg himself, as of right now, a week out from our primary election day here, has already spent about $12 million in ads. So by himself, he is outpacing what Clinton and Sanders did here in 16 by a wide margin.
We'll talk campaign spending in Michigan today. But first, geez, it's hard, isn't it? Watching all the Super Tuesday action and results, knowing it's not our turn until March 10th. There needs to be some kind of long German word for this, something that wraps up all the envy of watching other people get to vote, the disgust of other voters in other states choosing candidates different than we might have picked, the existential dread of it all. Brian Dickerson has been feeling it pretty hard this year. He's a columnist with the Detroit Free Press, and he's written about watching the voting happen in other states. Brian, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
You open the column by telling us, I feel like I'm in line at the ice cream stand, somewhere behind half a dozen little league teams and a couple of busloads of tourists, continuing to say by the time it's your turn to order, they'll be out of everything except vanilla. You've been here before, I take it?
I can't recall a time in Michigan when I've felt as irrelevant as I do as a voter this time around. But certainly that's been the experience of Michiganders for many election cycles, that by the time the circus comes to town, it's basically over in most elections. And that it's very unlikely that the race for the Democratic nomination will be over by March 10th, but the field will certainly be winnowed. If we believe what pollsters say about Super Tuesday, it's likely that only Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden and Mike Bloomberg will remain standing by the time they get to Michigan. And that's a very different field than the one we were looking at just 30 days ago.
Well, is there someone out there who you feel would have done well in Michigan who's not in the race anymore?
I know an awful lot of people in Michigan who really wanted to vote for a woman. I have a colleague at the Free Press who said, I just want to cast my vote with joy. And she didn't know whether she was going to vote for Elizabeth Warren or Amy Klobuchar, but she had narrowed it down to those two. And I asked her this morning, you know, how do you feel about voting with grim determination instead?
We can say that Michigan's primary falls late enough in the calendar that it doesn't really make a difference. But what about the fact that the guy who won the Democratic primary in Michigan last time around was Bernie Sanders? At the time, he had an outsider's chance at this, and yet he stunned people by beating the front runner, at the time Hillary Clinton, in what turned out to be a pretty consequential moment in forwarding his own agenda for this year. Can we really say that Michigan does not make a difference then?
Well, it didn't make a difference last time, mainly because people weren't paying close attention. I mean, we could rewind to the Michigan primary of 2016 and say that the Clinton campaign should have really had a wake-up call there and, you know, understood something about her negatives in Michigan and the direction of the Democratic Party here and responded to that. And they they didn't. They took Michigan for granted and didn't spend much time here during the general campaign. And we all know how that came out, a 10,000 vote victory for Donald Trump.
You write that it's outrageous that Michigan voters likely will have no opportunity to weigh in until after the winnowing of Super Tuesday is all but over. Why, though? Why should Michigan's vote matter more than, say, Illinois or California?
Because Michigan, I'm not sure those are two different questions. I'm not sure Michigan's vote should matter more than Illinois, because Illinois happens to be one of two states that looks more like the general population and resembles the aggregate United States on all kinds of metrics than Michigan does. Illinois and Florida are the two that come out ahead of Michigan on the representative of the rest of the country scale. But that's the reason. It's not a matter of what's fair or unfair to Michigan voters who, you know, as Humphrey Bogart said, our druthers don't amount to hill of beans in this crazy world. But it's very useful feedback for the Democratic Party to see how an electorate that closely resembles the rest of the country responds to the whole Democratic field. And now they've missed out on that learning experience. And so I think it's a tragedy, not so much for Michigan voters, but for the party that might have gotten some really important feedback going forward.
Am I hearing you make the case for Michigan rocketing to the front, maybe even ahead of Iowa?
I'd like to get out of that competition. What has always made sense to me is some kind of equity, not where nobody goes first, but everybody goes at the same time, the way we do in a general election.
Mm-hmm.
That makes some sense to me. The other thing, as a baby step toward that, would be regional primaries where, you know, the entire South voted on one day, the entire Midwest voted on one day, or maybe a combination of states with each of the major regions of the country represented, and, you know, changing the order from one election cycle to the next. It seems to me there are any number of ways to do it that make more sense than front-loading a whole bunch of states that are, A, quite small. I mean, the number of people who have voted in Democratic primaries or caucuses so far, I think, is smaller than the number of Democrats who will vote in Wayne County next week. And besides being small, they don't look very much like the rest of the United States.
Well, I do feel your pain as someone who used to cast her primary votes in the month of May as a resident of the great state of Oregon, when not only had the dust died down, but the stagecoach had actually left. But at the end of the day, what is a primary for, really? I mean, is this to figure out who is the most electable candidate? Or is it just to find out which candidates have the ideas that might motivate voters in different parts of the country?
Well, it's of different use to different people. If you're a political party trying to elect your candidates, not just your presidential candidate, but a whole slate of down-ballot candidates, then what the primary is for is, you know, it's like the tryouts for a Broadway musical. You want to find the strongest voice, the most appealing stars to champion your cause going forward. And if you're on the other side of the transaction, you're a voter, you want to have the opportunity to tell your party that they're headed in the right direction or the wrong direction.
You are still going to vote, though, on March 10th, are you not?
I surely am. I will probably cast an absentee ballot, but I will certainly not do that until after the dust settles from Super Tuesday. The Free Press also made the decision reluctantly not to endorse anyone until after Super Tuesday. It's a real conundrum for us because people have been voting in Michigan or have at least had the opportunity to vote since late January. And I think something like 400,000 already have. So they went ahead without the benefit of our thinking, and I feel badly about that. But it just seemed very likely that if we didn't wait, we might recommend a candidate who was no longer viable by the time the circus rolled into Michigan.
Brian Dickerson of the Detroit Free Press. Brian, thank you for stopping by and talking to us.
It's my pleasure.
We need to remember a proud native of Detroit, an actor, an interviewer, bon vivant, and one hell of a storyteller. James Lipton died yesterday at his home in Manhattan. He was 93. Lipton came up as a copy boy for the Detroit Times and a radio actor on WXYZ. He went on to serve in the Air Force, study acting with the great Stella Adler, do some shows on Broadway, and lead the New York Drama School that gave rise to the TV show Inside the Actor's Studio. He interviewed hundreds of people. He had many qualities, among them a good sense of humor. James Lipton was not offended when Will Ferrell sent up his dramatic stylings in this Saturday Night Live sketch.
An artist was born that would rival Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo. But his tools would not be pen, nor brush, nor chisel, nor palette. His tools would be his comically oversized glasses and his soul. So please, welcome the greatest performer ever to have graced this earth, Charles Nelson Reilly.
Lipton even did one better, offering a 30-second scroll of credits for himself at the front end of a promotional video taking us inside the actor's studio.
This is the medal of the Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters of the Republic of France, which knighted me. If you'd like to, you can come to the next joust. You're invited. This is the ACE Award, which called us the best talk show of the year in our third year of Inside the Actors Studio. This is the Lifetime Achievement Emmy of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences.
Lipton leaves behind a wife, Kedekai Turner, who once served as the model portraying Miss Scarlet on the box of the board game Clue. This guy was amazing. Farewell, James Lipton, and thanks. In just a moment, we'll hear how some public school districts are getting very involved in homeschooling.
The state pays a district based on how many kids it has. All the property taxes go to the state, and for the most part, they send it back to the districts based on how many kids. So if your district have 100 kids and you lose two, you lose, you know, about $16,000.
Stay with us. That story is just ahead. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you woke up with a Democratic primary hangover this morning, you've got company. People who voted for Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Tom Steyer, or other candidates who've dropped out now find themselves wondering if their vote can still be meaningful. That might include some people who voted absentee here in Michigan. We are here for you. Or, more specifically, Emma is here for you. Michigan Radio's digital producer Emma Winiwicki has been researching what exactly you need to do to cast a vote if you've already cast one prior. This is referred to as spoiling your ballot. Emma, I'm so confused. Is it just me at this point?
No, it's really confusing. A lot of people have no idea what's going on. They've already voted, their candidates have dropped out, and they don't really know what to do next. But in Michigan, if you have voted absentee, you are allowed to spoil your ballot. That's the official term. It essentially means you can ask your clerk to cancel the vote that you've already submitted and redo it.
Have clerks gone through this process before?
They have, but this is different this time because the absentee voting has changed since the last time we had a big election. Now, Michigan voters have said that you can vote absentee no matter what. So there are a lot more ballots this year. A lot more have been requested. A lot more have been submitted. And so clerks are having to deal with a lot more possible spoilings.
Just a lot of new information.
It's constant.
Well, let's get to it. Emma, I personally am a new Michigan voter. Can I still do that? Can I get an absentee ballot if I have not voted in Michigan before?
You can. If you are registered to vote, you are allowed to request an absentee ballot before 5 p.m. Friday.
Whoa, that's coming right up.
It is.
Let's say I voted for Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg, and I want to cast a mail-in ballot now for somebody else. Can I still do that?
So if you've already cast your ballot for, say, Pete Buttigieg, you can cancel your ballot. There are a couple ways to do it. If you want to do it by mail again, you have to submit a request to your city clerk by 2 p.m. on Saturday that you would like to vote again, and they will spoil your ballot. They'll send you a new one, and you have to send it back in by 8 p.m. on election day, just like if you were voting absentee brand new.
Saturday the 7th.
Yes.
So what if I'm just feeling really, really super urgent about this? I just want to go fill out my absentee ballot in person and get it done at the clerk's office. Can I still do that?
You can still do that. You can go to your clerk's office. You can say, I would like to spoil my ballot. They'll pull it up for you. They'll spoil it. They'll say, no good. And you can redo it right there in person at the clerk's office. You get more time to do that, too. You have until 4 p.m. Monday before the election to spoil it in person.
Okay, I have a confession to make. I just can't deal with deadlines. If I already voted, can I just show up next week and redo my absentee ballot in person, as it were?
You cannot. If it's after 4 p.m. on Monday and you have already voted absentee, that is your vote.
Emma, you're awesome. Thanks for figuring this out for us.
No problem.
Emma Winawicki. Go to michiganradio.org for Emma's amazing voter's guide to absentee ballots in Michigan. It's available right now. Homeschooling is one way for parents to take a more direct role in their kids' education. It's not in the cards for everyone, but people who do it often say they can't imagine having their children learn any other way. You may or may not know that public schools have an increasingly large role in homeschooling. Mike Wilkinson is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. Bridge has just published a pair of investigative stories that go inside an increasingly intertwined relationship between some of the state's school districts and homeschoolers. Mike Wilkinson, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, the meat of the story is unpacking why some school districts are paying attention to and indeed even participating in a homeschool education for kids in their area. Why would they do that?
Well, many districts in the state of Michigan are hurting financially. Enrollment is going down, and in Michigan, it's one of 38 states where the state pays a district based on how many kids it has. It's not, you know, there's, you know, in some states, the local community will raise taxes, and it's independent of how many students. But in Michigan, all the property taxes go to the state, and for the most part, they send it back to the districts based on how many kids. So if your district of 100 kids and you lose two, you lose, you know,
it's X about, amount of dollars.
You lose about $16,000. So just demographically, the state has lost 6% of its school-age population in the last 15 years or so.
Because of birth rates going down and other factors.
We've gone up in age, and, you know, we're stagnant in terms of population. We're not growing as much. So that means these districts are losing population. And you can't cut your way to keep up a lot of times. You know, you've got a 1,000-student district. It loses 20 kids. Well, you could say that's a class. You can get rid of a teacher. Well, one left in 12th grade, one 11th grade, one, you know, on and on and on. So you really can't cut a classroom or a teacher or a school, but you've lost $160,000. So a lot of districts have turned to other avenues. They're using the School of Choice program to kind of encourage students from other districts, which has created its own kind of competition. But what we found is that homeschool was another avenue that they've discovered that, you know, you offering virtual classes and then these in-person private lessons that we talk about, you know, they're not all private, but they were able to then build a state for the sewing or cooking or karate or ice skating class that these kids took. And so it meant more money for them. We do know from research that an online class is, you know, probably 25% cheaper. But in Michigan, what the state sends the district is not based on how much it costs. So if the kid is a homeschool student and he gets a dollar for his education, whether or not he's a brick and mortar student. So there's a big difference there in cost. And so there's the incentive is already baked in for them to kind of try to find these low cost alternatives to kind of boost their enrollment and their revenue.
Did you notice any pattern to the kind of schools that are reaching out to homeschoolers, whether in terms of geography or in terms of the demographics of the school?
Well, and no, I mean, they're all over the state. You know, they're in the Upper Peninsula and the Western Upper Peninsula. They're in Traverse City. They're Kalamazoo, Southeast Michigan. It did not seem to be a pattern. I think all of them kind of acknowledged that there were some financial concerns. I mean, the Oxford schools, which, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about some of the problems. The Oxford schools in Northern Oakland County have not gotten in any trouble from an auditor. They make bones, no bones about it, that they did this for partially for financial reasons. 15% of their revenue and their students are in their virtual academy. And what they've done is they've turned around and said, okay, so no kid has to pay to be in the band. No one has to pay to play, you know, volleyball or football. We'll even supply the, as they said, the bows and arrows for the kid in the archery club. Not every district can do that. And the reason they can do that is because they've gotten all this additional money. And they're able to kind of bank some of that, and because it's a lower cost than their traditional kids.
So, I mean, we can say that there's a financial incentive for some districts to offer these classes. It sounds like the revenue is not insubstantial.
Oh, no. I mean, it was over $29 million in the 2017-18 school year. It was $27 million last year.
$29 million across all the states, districts.
And for a district like Oxford, I mean, that, you know, you're talking about 15% of their revenue, and it amounts to over $4 million in new revenue. Again, there's a cost. I mean, they are spending some money, but they're able then to, as they said, pull off some of that profit and benefit their own kids. I mean, one of the criticisms is while Oxford and the Hamilton schools and Madison are doing it and taking this profit, it's not going to other districts. I mean, there's a lot of districts in the state that would love to have their kids not pay to play baseball or volleyball. They'd love to have more counselors or more, mental health counselors that Oxford touts, but they can't. But these districts have found it, and they found a way to help themselves out.
Well, is there, I mean, we talked about the fact that when kids leave a district, you can't necessarily cut your way out of the red. But is a zero-sum approach the way to look at the money that goes to the districts to support homeschoolers too? If that money weren't being paid into districts like Oxford, would it necessarily go to the other districts that are in financial need?
Well, it's coming out of the school aid budget and the fund. And if the money was there, if the $29 million was there, the $160 million that's going to the parochial schools, there, when the legislature was being asked to pay more per pupil, maybe it goes up $10, $20, $30, $40 per pupil, but it's not there because it is going to these other programs.
What kinds of classes are offered in this way? It sounded like the kind of things you mentioned, ice skating, sewing, tend to be electives?
It's absolutely all electives, and that's because the court decision in state law has kind of prohibited, the state cannot spend public school dollars on a private school. They can spend it on a private student, but court decisions have narrowed that down to non-essential services and classes. So they can't offer English, they can't offer reading, science. So they have to focus on these electives. And that's where some of the criticism comes. The typical fifth grader, name that district, might go to PE or gym class, an art class, or a music class once a week, but all combined, it's 1/6 of their year, right? And so if the state gives that district $8,000 for that kid, you could argue that a $1,300 is electives. In these programs where the kids are taking ice skating and karate and ballet, they're stacking them up as if they're taking 4/6 of a day, 2/3 of their day, 3/4 of their day as electives. And that's what the state said. Wait a minute, the regular kids aren't doing this. Why are we paying extra for these students? And because these are not, it's not what we're doing everywhere else. And the traditional school, when it gets its money, that kid has to take assessment tests. They have to pay for administration. And these homeschool kids, they're not taking the MSTEP test. The district is not being judged by their performance on these electives. So people have been kind of critical of them.
You drilled down on a case study that we mentioned, the Oxford Public Schools in Oakland County. And just again, 15% of the kids who are on paper enrolled in the district are homeschool kids who are participating in electives in this way. Can you tell us a little bit more about, what the district is like and what you heard from the superintendent about how it got like this?
Well, they started it, a little less than a decade ago, and they were looking at, in Oakland County, they're very quick to point out that they do not get the same amount of money as some of the other districts. Some of the other districts get more revenue because, when the state completely revamped its funding system in 95, they got more, so they got it baked in that they get more. And their enrollment was flat. So they were looking for a way to raise revenue. So There's a number of districts that have worked with something called the Michigan Co-op EdTech Specialist, which is a consulting firm, and they were telling districts about this way to offer virtual education. And then it just morphed into and it got bigger. You know, so they've created this suite of classes where you kind of watch the class online, and then you know you go to the horse stables for a horse riding lesson every week, or you go to the music store and take a music lesson, and then it ends up being something that they're going to bill the state, saying, "Hey, this kid did this."
Is there any oversight for what kind of instruction gets offered by public schools for homeschoolers?
Well, it does not appear so. Someone raised the question in one of the audits that these classes did not have the rigor of other classes. And the attorneys for the district said, rigor is not a standard, and it's not. You know, the state doesn't audit district classes and say, you know, basket weaving is not the equal of pottery. But you have these classes, and one thing that the Macomb Intermediate School District told me was when they drilled down and watched some of the online classes that were being offered to these students, it was the same class whether the kid was in third grade, second grade, or fifth grade. Their argument was the online class was kind of a shell. The real class was the weekly, you know, visit to
in-person hands-on learning.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is a component. Is that necessarily a component of all these classes? Do they all have to have an in-person piece of it?
Well, I don't know if they all have them, but you know, there's a number of the districts, Traverse City, Niles, and Centerline were criticized heavily by the state for what they called private lessons. Now, Oxford has said they don't do private lessons; they're optional. And there's no fewer than three kids can ever go to the karate class or whatever, because as they told me, if one kid's sick, they don't want to ever be accused of it getting down to one kid, and they call them optional. Now, the Macomb folks say, you know, optional is that's kind of a ruse. I mean, it really is a private lesson. When you look at some of the sheets that the kids have to fill out saying, hey, what did you do last week? To be part of a virtual, I got to back up here, because when you're a virtual class, you have to prove that you actually did the class. Much like in a traditional classroom, you have to attendance, was Johnny there the 5 days? So in the virtual setting, the school district has to prove to the state, if they want the money, that the kid actually was engaged. So at least twice a week, they have to have an email, some kind of contact with the student. So as part of some of the records that we got, you look at the emails and it says, you know, what did you do last week in the pottery class? And they never mention, oh, I learned about, you know, the masters of modern pottery. They always like, I made a candle holder. I made a cup. It was always about the hands-on thing. So is the hands-on in-person thing required? It seems that it was what the families were focused on. But like in Oxford said, they said it was optional. Interestingly, I did ask the principal of the Oxford school. I go, how would someone learn karate if they never took a karate class? And their reply was, well, they could watch all the videos, and then they could practice at home, and then they could take a video of themselves and then send it in for a grade.
And that's how it worked.
That's what she said would how it could work.
Since you've outlined all this, have there been any significant changes to the state laws that made it possible, or is anybody talking about changing it?
Well, I mean, there's a discussion to talk about, should virtual schools get the same amount of money? As look at the cost issue. There's no decision yet. You know, the governor currently wants us to look at cost. On the other end, in a way, saying, okay, some kids need more money. You know, they cost more to educate, and they're at-risk kids. They have needs that should be met. There's a counter argument as well. If we're going to go there, well, let's look at these virtual schools and maybe, you know, since they don't have to pay for heat and cooling and on the building, there's not a janitor and the attendant things that go along with a traditional big brick and mortar school.
Should they maybe get that much
should
money?
Should we get so? Yeah. You know, there are some legislators who are looking at this now. Whether it goes into this level, we're not sure.
Has anyone done any serious research to look at how this is affecting outcomes?
Not necessarily outcomes, but finances. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan, which you know we collaborated with a little bit on the story, you know they were looking at some of the similar, very similar issues, has been monitoring the increased use of shared time within the state, and they just came out with a report yesterday, looking at just the growth in the population and the money going to homeschool kids and those kids that are in private schools. And there's a third element, and that is the number of districts that are adding a second year of kindergarten for children who are just barely too young to be in kindergarten. And it's all out from the same point of view. It's a way to add enrollment and get more money from the state.
You know, there are people who homeschool their kids because their children have special needs. You know, maybe they just learn differently, or maybe they actually have cognitive difference. And for some people, like, a traditional academic education wasn't really in the cards for their kid, and it might be okay with them. What has attention to the issue meant for the future of homeschooling programs?
Part of what you mentioned is one of the reasons these all started, right? So when the internet comes out and we have the ability to offer online programs, there were a lot of kids who dropped out of school who just didn't feel comfortable in the traditional setting, the brick and mortar setting. And this was a boon for them. I mean, this was a great thing to give them another opportunity. A lot of people who, you know, were able to come back and try to, you know, soldier on and get the diploma or the GED. So that is kind of the foundation of where these are, why we have a lot of these programs. You know, there's a lot of virtual schools in the state. What's happened is that model's been taken to offer something to this community. I don't know if it's going to affect ultimately whether it's offered. I mean, I know some are arguing that you can keep doing it. Let's just follow the rules. Let's not have five electives. Let's have one. The question becomes, would a district do it if the financial incentive is gone?
Mike Wilkinson is an investigative reporter with Bridge Magazine. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You can read his stories by following a link on our website. Super Tuesday marks the first time that voters will see Mike Bloomberg's name on an actual ballot. If you're a Michigan voter, chances are you've already been seeing plenty of the former New York City mayor in the form of TV and radio ads, promoted social media content, maybe some mailers to your house. Coming up on Stateside, we'll discuss Bloomberg's $12 million and counting bet on Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. While some of the biggest names in the race to become the Democratic presidential nominee dropped out ahead of Super Tuesday, one candidate's big gamble didn't even start until today. Mike Bloomberg has spent a huge amount of money in Michigan ahead of the state's primary next week. Abigail Sansky reports he's making a pitch to moderates in the state.
It's overcast and snows in the forecast in Saginaw, Michigan, one of the 12 counties in the state that voted twice for President Obama and then for President Trump. The presidential primary is coming up, and Kelly Green is out canvassing for Mike Bloomberg.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My name is Kelly. I'm from the Mike Bloomberg campaign. How are you doing today?
Elizabeth Krakowski is an older woman with gray hair and hearing aids. She says she's considering Bloomberg.
I've heard all the commercials.
Have you?
Yeah, and I've seen them all on TV. Uh-huh. So I've seen a lot of them, and yeah.
So have you?
Mike Bloomberg has monopolized ad time in Michigan. According to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, he spent almost $12 million. That's more than both Republican and Democratic candidates spent in the run-up to the primary in 2016. Antha Williams is a senior advisor to the Bloomberg campaign.
We're making really big investments in the places where, frankly, no one has been campaigning other than Donald Trump.
The Bloomberg campaign opened 10 offices across the state, stepping out of the Metro Detroit bubble to places like Saginaw, Traverse City, and Kalamazoo. It has the biggest footprint of any Democratic campaign with over 100 paid staffers. Dave Adams is a teacher who's been a longtime member of the Saginaw County Democrats. He says he's never seen an office this early in Saginaw.
I actually don't think I remember a presidential candidate having their own office ever.
That infrastructure is part of the bet Bloomberg is placing on Michigan in order to have a shot at winning the state's primary. Maurice Patterson is one of Bloomberg's regional field directors. The retired firefighter has lived in Saginaw all of his life, and now he's hitting the pavement for Bloomberg. He knocks on a door and finds it's one of his old friends, M.T. Thompson.
I'm watching him.
You're leaning? You're leaning towards him?
I'll say only because I don't think Bernie can win.
Okay.
Saginaw has lost tens of thousands of people in the last decade. Schools have closed and crime has gone up.
People go to college, they don't come back. There's not a lot of jobs here anymore.
like it used to be. We used to be a General Motors plant city. We had 9 General Motors plants. Now we have 1. So all those jobs left. That was 30,000 jobs that's gone.
In the past 4 years, the city has seen a number of reinvestments. Patterson says people have started to move back downtown. That improvement is part of what could be making local Democrats nervous a progressive Democrat couldn't beat Trump. Patterson says he thinks only a moderate can oust the president. But Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders did win the state's 2016 primary. Garrett Arwa is a former executive director of the Michigan Democratic Party. He led Democratic campaigns in the state during the Obama years. He says he's skeptical that Bloomberg's unprecedented bet on Michigan will pay off.
Bernie Sanders, by virtue of the infrastructure he had from the last time he ran, probably is in the driver's seat to some extent in Michigan, or at least considered the favorite. I just find it very hard to believe that unless Bloomberg proves that he can win delegates, that he is going to win delegates in Michigan.
If Bloomberg doesn't do well on Super Tuesday, his path to winning Michigan delegates next week could narrow, even with a massive campaign footprint. In Saginaw, I'm Abigail Sensky.
Here to help us wrap our collective minds around the campaign spending and Bloomberg's entry into the race is Craig Mauger, political reporter with the Detroit News. Hey, Craig, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The article that you wrote recently about Mike Bloomberg's campaign talked about the amount of money he spent in Michigan, and you used the word unprecedented. I take it that was a pretty intentional choice of words. Can you help us understand how he stacks up?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to many experts who have been following money and politics in the state for many decades, and I've been following it for a short term, and nothing compares in a presidential primary to the self-financed campaign that former Mayor Bloomberg, is running in the state right now.
How does it compare? I mean, I think I heard Abigail say that he'd spent more on ads in this year's primary than other candidates had spent for the entire race.
I mean, to compare to 2016, in 2016, we had a pretty competitive presidential primary here between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and they were running a lot of ads for multiple weeks out in front of the March 8th primary that year. Those two campaigns combined to spend about $8 million. So that was a lot of ads. Bloomberg himself, as of right now, a week out from our primary election day here, has already spent about $12 million in ads. So by himself, he is outpacing what Clinton and Sanders did here in 16 by a wide margin.
Craig, just to give people a sense of how, if you don't consume a lot of internet, how prevalent these ads are, my kid is able to summarize some of Mike Bloomberg's campaign talking points. She is 9, and she has been seeing ad after ad of his on YouTube. What do we know about how much Mike Bloomberg is targeting his ads in the state?
I mean, in this day and age of social media, campaigns that are sophisticated, like the Bloomberg campaign, can do a lot of targeting on Facebook and on YouTube to make sure that specific messages get to specific voters. And that happens through the mail, too. Some of the mail pieces that some voters are likely getting are probably different than the mail pieces that other voters are getting. I mean, that's what sophisticated campaigns do. And when you have a lot of money, you're able to be more sophisticated than others.
Do we know what areas of the state he's spending in?
We have a little bit of an idea, specifically on the TV ads. There are about $11.8 million in TV ads so far, according to the nonprofit Michigan Campaign Finance Network. I dove into the specific ad buy contracts that have to be disclosed in the Metro Detroit market and found that $5.1 million of his spending has been in Metro Detroit. So he's heavily targeted Metro Detroit. Of course, that's where a plurality of the voters are in the state in a Democratic primary. It's also where Hillary Clinton got a lot of her votes in the 2016 campaign against Bernie. I mean, she was only able to win 10 of our state's 83 counties against Sanders in the 2016 primary, and 3 of them were Macomb, Oakland, and Wayne counties in southeast Michigan.
You don't even have to be online to really see what's going on. There are billboards all around Detroit saying Mike will end the chaos. Do we know who else is spending money in Michigan right now?
Yeah, as it stands right now, Bernie Sanders' campaign and Elizabeth Warren's campaigns have started running TV advertisements. Other campaigns have been spending money for a while in terms of at least having some level of staffing here. But when it comes to the TV advertising, those two campaigns have begun their ad buys here. The Biden campaign, I think, is going to be beginning its TV advertising here very shortly. So it's likely that the airwaves in the state are going to get a little more crowded with political ads than they've already been in the coming days.
Yeah, one can only imagine that it's going to get pretty intense over the next week. Michigan is in a new sort of political hot seat this year. The so-called blue wall, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, states that traditionally have voted blue, flipped in 2016 and went for Donald Trump. And there are a lot of national observers trying to see if that trend is going to repeat this year. Do you expect the spending to look different for the general election after all the primaries than what we saw 4 or 8 years ago?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think 4 years ago, the Clinton campaign kind of, it seemed like, thought that they were going to win this state until the final weeks before Election Day. And now, standing here, you know, 8 months out of Election Day in November, both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, are focused in on Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And there are other states that could become part of this and could see a lot of attention. But I think both sides are really focused in on these three states as three states that could potentially decide this election. Just look at the number of visits that we've already seen from Vice President Pence and President Trump. Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania are going to be at the forefront of this for many months to come.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the ads that might be bought for some of the other races. There's an active Senate campaign and some very key House races that will be decided in the general election as well. Who benefits from all the spending?
Well, I mean, at the very front of it are the TV stations. I mean, they make a lot of money when there are competitive elections going on. The $5 million in ads that Bloomberg is spending in the Metro Detroit broadcast market, of course, benefits those TV stations. It benefits consultants who help place these buys. And there is information being put out to voters in some ways. You could argue about what that benefit is, but it does to a certain degree help raise attention about the election coming up, and it gets people to some extent energized about Election Day, whether it's for the candidate running all the ads or because they're sick of the ads that they're seeing on their TVs.
Do we know if spending on ads necessarily delivers political wins?
It doesn't. I mean, in terms of all of the study that's out there, it doesn't guarantee results. I mean, there's no direct connection. If you spend this amount of money, you are going to win the election. I mean, there is a trend where candidates who spend the most tend to do better than candidates who don't spend the most. But there's not a direct connection. If I spend this amount of money, I'm going to win. There are a lot of other things that come into play. What's the candidate's connection to the voters? What's the candidate's background? Who are the other candidates that are going to be on the ballot? I mean, there are so many different things. And as Dave Duleo, a professor at Oakland University, said recently, he said money is not a silver bullet. It doesn't guarantee a result.
What are you keeping track of over the next couple of months?
We'll be keeping track of some of these U.S. House races in Michigan that could be very competitive, the 8th and 11th districts, who are going to be the Republican nominees to take on Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens, how much a Republican's going to spend to try to win back these seats that swung against them in 2018. We're going to be following this U.S. Senate race, likely between John James and Gary Peters, and we're going to continue to follow the presidential race. I mean, there's a lot at stake in Michigan in 2020, and these are all races that are going to have our eyes on them.
I feel like we've been talking so much about ads for the presidential contests and the campaigns themselves, we maybe haven't even acknowledged the role that super PACs and other outside groups might have in this year's spending. Is that something that you track?
Yeah, we'll be tracking the outside spending, specifically in the U.S. House and U.S. Senate races. Outside groups, these are super PACs that can accept corporate contributions and can accept unlimited amounts of money from individual donors and can spend unlimited amounts of money. These are often the entities that drive up the cost of elections, specifically for U.S. House and U.S. Senate campaigns. In the presidential race this year, there have begun to be some super PACs spending on behalf of certain Democratic candidates candidates or against other Democratic candidates. And we haven't seen, to a large degree, that type of spending in Michigan's primary yet. But these groups can launch their ad buys very quickly. And after today, Super Tuesday, when the focus turns to Michigan, we might see some advertising by groups like that very, very soon.
Craig, on the one side in the Republican presidential chase, President Trump's campaign has raised a record amount of money, really a lot. On the other side, Mike Bloomberg is in the Democratic primary and could possibly choose to keep spending whether or not he gets the Democratic nomination. With such large war chests on both sides, maybe some might assume that the super PACs might not need to be as active this year. Is that necessarily the case?
I don't think that's the case. No, I mean, if Mayor Bloomberg does drop out of this race at some point, what he's done previously is spend his money through a super PAC. His super PAC has been called Independence USA. And in our 2018 U.S. House races in Michigan, his super PAC was the top spender when it came to the races in the 8th and 11th district here. So super PACs are going to play a large role in this regardless, because if you're a large donor who wants to either influence the race for President Trump or against President Trump, spending money through a super PAC is the most effective way to do it, because you control the message and because there's no limit on how much you can give. So a single donor can bankroll a super PAC to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and even beyond that.
Craig, thanks for tracking this stuff. I'm sure we'll be talking again before November.
Thank you for having me on.
Craig Mauger is a reporter with the Detroit News. With all the heat and light surrounding the Democratic presidential primary, it's easy to forget that the primary election for several key Republican candidates will actually be held much later this year. Our Capitol correspondent Rick Pluta joins us now with a little primary explainer. Rick, how you doing?
Hi.
So Republicans will have presidential choices to vote on if they choose to cast a ballot in March, correct?
That is true. There are, in fact, along with President Donald Trump, three other Republicans running. Mark Sanford from South Carolina, trying to resurrect his career. Joe Walsh, Bill Weld, former Massachusetts governor, sort of trying to make a point that there are still moderate Republicans. But no one is expecting that anyone other than the president is going to actually win Michigan in the upcoming primary.
But what are the key races that might not shape up until much later this summer?
Well, they don't shape up because the March primary is only candidates for president, and in fact, only the Republican and Democratic candidates for president. That later on in August, we will have primaries for the U.S. Senate. That incumbent Gary Peters will almost certainly win the Democratic nomination, but there are other Republicans running to seeking the nomination to run against him, and it looks like that's going to be John James, who ran and lost against Debbie Stabenow now the last time around. Plus, we've got, all the congressional and legislative seats that are up as well.
Rick, how did we get to this point where Michigan's primary sort of plays out over two stages?
Well, because on the one hand, that the nominations for congressional and state offices is set in law, and it's just become the standard, is that Michigan has over the years moved its presidential primary, or sometimes caucuses, around in order to maximize its influence, with mixed results, to say the least. That some of these have been just flat out disasters and embarrassments where, the nomination process has gone to court. And so that sort of quieted the effort to try and make Michigan a kingmaker. And so now we are in that cluster of states that follows Super Tuesday, kind of mini Tuesday that comes after that.
Tuesday extra. Right.
Mm-hmm. Tuesday extra. That's a good one.
Would you say that the staggered primary calendar has consequences for candidates? I mean, it sounds kind of crazy if you're considering running for office in November to only have things decided in August for who the party's nominee is going to be.
Well, it actually, I would say that it works well for both the parties and the down ballot races, because that way they're not consumed with presidential politics, because that just becomes the singular focus of the election. So I think from a party standpoint and from a lower on the ballot candidate standpoint, that you kind of want the presidential dealt with on a separate date, preferably far away from the primary that you're going to be running in.
Rick Pluta reports on politics for Michigan's public radio stations from Lansing. Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, a pleasure as always.
That's our show today. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the agendas that presidential candidates are putting forth to talk with Black voters. A writer for The Root has put together a fascinating profile comparing and contrasting Democrats who are vying for voters' attention in key places like Detroit. That's it for our show. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.